This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Gazing into the cauldron of corporate profits.
Trying to get a read on our economic destiny.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, April the 19th.
Coming up, what happens when you actually ask people about the market for jobs?
And the connection between zoning laws and the quality of public schools.
Plus, capitalizing on the tendency to open up a new Mac and say, hooah!
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The corporate earnings reports are flooding in this morning. We've got companies like Southwest and Verizon telling us how they did in the first part of this year. In recent quarters, companies have padded their profits by cutting costs. But as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, that is starting to change.
After the markets closed yesterday, Yum! Brands, better known as KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, turned in a strong quarter, thanks especially to lots of chicken sales in China. This morning, Bank of America reported lower profits as the big bank's debts from the financial crisis continue to weigh on earnings. Microsoft issues its quarterly report later this afternoon. The software giant hasn't kept up with the transition from desktop computers to smartphones and tablets. But Richard DeKayser at the Parthenon Group says overall companies are beginning to spend more money on hiring workers.
We've had spectacular profit growth during the first 2 years of economic expansion, and we're beginning now to see a transition. We're seeing profit growth slow as increasingly we see rising shares of national income going to employee compensation.
And with more spending money in their pockets, DeKayser says consumers should help extend the economic recovery. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, for more on corporate earnings, let's go to Cash Mansouri, an economic consultant who writes for the blog The Street Light. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the two big banks that reported earnings this morning. Bank of America, which has had a lot of trouble with bad mortgages, it reported a drop in profit. And Morgan Stanley, which lost money overall but saw a big uptick in its investment banking business. What's the takeaway here?
Well, I think the takeaway is that the financial sector in the U.S. is doing better than it did a year or two ago, but we're not out of the woods yet. Operationally, they're making some money, but you have to keep an eye on their balance sheets, which have these sort of swings that remind us that they are not completely out of the woods.
Not completely out of the woods. Well, one place that we've been looking in recent quarters for some real strong growth has been the tech world. We're going to hear from Microsoft later today. We heard from Intel and eBay over the last couple of days. A lot of talk that maybe the tech boom is starting to peak. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the tech industry is notoriously cyclical, right? And we've been through boom and bust cycles before, and we've had a great boom for the last few years, so it's only natural to wonder if we may be nearing the peak of that. And, you know, the wobbliness of Apple's share price in recent days makes you wonder about that.
You don't think Apple's just going to keep going up and up and up?
Well, you know, every trend can only continue until it stops. And, you know, you would have said that Microsoft's stock price was going to go up and up and up in the mid-1990s, yet at some point the laws of gravity do apply.
Cash Mansouri, thanks a lot.
You're quite welcome.
Two European countries went shopping for a lot more money today. Spain and France needed to sell billions of dollars worth of government bonds. Things had been looking marginally better in Europe over the past couple months after the European Central Bank started handing out $1 trillion in emergency loans. But that money is beginning to run out, and today government borrowing was an important test, which today at least Spain has passed. Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard has more.
The French government has seen its borrowing costs or bond yields go up in recent days. Investors are worrying about politics. There's the first round of the presidential election this Sunday, and the current conservative president, Nicolas Sarkozy, has fallen way behind his socialist rival in the opinion polls, as broker Bill Blaine told the BBC.
The markets are beginning to get a little bit nervous about what a change in the French government is going to mean. I suspect that we are likely to see French government bond yields rise in the next couple of weeks.
He says investors fear that if the socialist candidate wins the election, France won't take the necessary steps to cut its budget deficit. And there's another worry. Germany has backed Sarkozy to win. If he doesn't, a big rift could open up in the heart of Europe. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A report out today from the Brookings Institution offers a theory on how to improve education for poor kids. Change zoning laws. For an explanation, here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer from our Wealth and Poverty Desk.
It's a busy morning at the Bruce Monroe Elementary School in Washington. Third grader Marcus King sits to one side of his classroom by himself. His mother, Teresa King, meets me there to talk about her dreams for Marcus, who has special needs. First off, a move to a better school district.
I would go. No questions. I would definitely go.
King moved to Washington less than a year ago from a Maryland suburb where Marcus's classes were small.
He needs that one-on-one, not just someone standing there saying, take out a piece of paper, write your name, because he doesn't understand that.
When King lost her job in Maryland, she and Marcus moved into public housing in the city. It wasn't available in the suburbs. Jonathan Rothwell says that's no accident. He wrote the Brookings report on zoning.
In most metropolitan areas, it's impossible to build affordable housing in affluent neighborhoods because of zoning laws.
Those laws don't allow apartment buildings or townhouses. Rothwell says zoning laws should be changed to require construction of affordable housing so low-income students can go to the best schools. But urban policy consultant Wendell Cox says ultimately,
the way to improve educational performance is by fixing the schools.
In every neighborhood. Rothwell says that'll take years. It's more practical to change zoning laws to give kids like Marcus King a better education so they can scramble a little higher on the economic ladder. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now, let's take a trip to the supermarket.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. You have a great day.
Whole Foods, to be exact, on 3rd Street here in Los Angeles. The upscale, often expensive chain is about to make a big change. No, they're not lowering their prices. On Sunday, Earth Day, Whole Foods will stop selling wild seafood that's either overfished or caught in a harmful way, according to the ratings from the Blue Ocean Institute and the Monterey Bay Aquarium. On our trip to Whole Foods, we met up with David Ginsberg, an environmental biologist from the University of Southern California.
What's happened is that we've become too comfortable with what's out in the natural world. And while we want the health benefits of some food items, particularly fish, at the same time, we don't want to pay the real cost of those.
Yeah, well, I see that on the avoid list, you've got things like tilapia, which I see right there, fresh tilapia, mahi-mahi, salmon farmed, including Atlantic. These are a lot of things that people have all the time.
Sure, and I think that the question that many people have is, should they be eating these and are they sustainable choices? And Whole Foods is moving in a direction to say some of these are not sustainable and will not actually support them.
Well, give us the scientific view on this. How serious of a problem is this that Whole Foods is reacting in this way and deciding to take some stuff right off their shelves?
Well, for example, tuna. Tuna fisheries are in great danger right now. Tuna is becoming less and less available in the environment. Yet we still see it as an everyday item, from canned tuna to items in a restaurant or in the supermarket. The question is, are we actually paying the real price of that fish? And does the consumer actually have an idea of what their consumption of that fish is doing to the environment?
Now, when we look down this line, we see prices like $8.99 a pound or $13.99 a pound or even $21.99 a pound for this Alaskan king salmon. What should we be paying, really, for stuff like this right now?
I think for some of these, in the case of, say, tuna or some of these other options, it should be at least double or triple the price.
I've got a friend who said to me a couple of years ago about this issue, I want to order as much ahi tuna and yellowfin tuna as I can right now because in 10 years it'll cost $100 to get it.
I'm not so sure there will be ahi tuna and big eye tuna and others in the next 20 or 30 years available.
It's that fast. We're really that close to the end of that kind of stuff.
For some of these, we are.
David Ginsberg is a marine environmental biologist at the Environmental Studies Program at the University of Southern California. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
There's news today that the number of people signing up for unemployment benefits in the last week fell, but not by as much as experts were predicting. And a four-week average is actually up. All this adds up to a sense that finding a job is getting slightly tougher in the U.S. But how's the job market doing if you actually ask people? That's the subject of our weekly Attitude Check, a partnership with Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Joining us now, Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, David.
So give me the latest gauge, as it were, of how Americans are feeling about this job market.
Well, I would say good news, bad news. How's that for a little ambiguity? Let me give you a couple of examples. 77% of Americans say in our April update that now is a bad time to find a quality job. So that seems pretty miserable. However, as recently as November, that was up at 90%. So there's a definite improvement, but still the significant majority of Americans say it's not a great time to be finding a quality job. A quarter of Americans tell us that unemployment still remains the most important problem facing the country. That's second only to general mentions of the economy. Now that's high, but unemployment mentions were at 30% just a few months ago, so that's down as well. Here's an interesting figure for you, which I think is very important. 68% of Americans, David, tell us that they personally know somebody who has been laid off or lost their job within the last 6 months, and that's as high as we've ever measured that figure.
Anyone who keeps an eye on sociology knows there's often a difference between when you ask a question about the person, how are you feeling or how is the job picture to you compared to what's going on around you. Sometimes there's a gap.
Ah, very shrewd insight. People have written about it. We've been measuring that at Gallup for a number of years. Some authors have called that the optimism gap. One person said it's the I'm okay, you're not syndrome. In other words, when you ask me about myself, I'm doing fine. But when you ask me about what's happening out there across the country, things are not nearly as positive. And we certainly have an example of it when it comes to jobs. Here's an example. We ask Americans who are working, thinking about the next 12 months, how likely is it that you will lose your job or be laid off, you personally? And only 15% of Americans said that was even fairly likely. In fact, only 5% said very likely. So despite those figures I gave you a moment ago, most of us who are working blissfully say, hey, that's not going to affect me. I'm perfectly fine here in my job.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup, joins us every Thursday. Frank, thank you for this.
My pleasure.
Enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Another casualty of the poor economy in recent years, the 16-year-old behind the wheel. According to a study conducted by the Frontier Group and the U.S. PIRG Education Fund, the number of young Americans without a driver's license has risen in the last decade.
In fact, now a full quarter of the 14-year-old to 34-year-old age group in the U.S. can't legally drive. Is this a cultural shift or some sign of the economic times we live in? Here to talk with us is Tony Dutzik of Frontier Group. He's a senior policy analyst there. He co-authored the study. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, David.
Give me a sense of what you actually did find about why fewer young people seem to be driving.
What we found was that between 2001 and 2009, that the number of miles driven by the average 16 to 34-year-old dropped by about 23%, which is a huge decline. And part of it, as you said, is because fewer young people have driver's licenses. But part of it is also that among those young people who do have driver's licenses, they're making fewer trips, and they're taking and those trips that they are taking are shorter.
Is it in part because perhaps people are living in the cities more and they don't need a driver's license, or are they making this choice by themselves? What's the reason?
Well, I think there's a few different reasons, and you'd earlier mentioned the impact of the economy, which definitely has a very significant impact. People who have jobs tend to drive more miles than people who don't,
right.
And we've seen unemployment, particularly among young people, remain very high throughout this recession. So certainly the economy has some impact. What we've found, though, is that there are a number of other factors that are at play. One of them certainly is gasoline prices. Which are likely to stay high pretty much for the foreseeable future. For previous generations of Americans, low gas prices were always seen as something of a birthright. But for this generation of young Americans, high gas prices are just a fact of life, and they're beginning to adjust their patterns of behavior and the way that they get around in order to accommodate that. You'd also mentioned the idea that people are increasingly desiring to live in cities. And that's certainly true of many young people. The survey data suggests that young people are increasingly likely to value living within walking distance of amenities like shops and restaurants. They're biking and using public transportation more. And they're increasingly attracted to living in urban areas.
Biking and using public transportation more. That is a shift from a generation earlier.
It is. And, I think that one of the other trends that we have been looking at, in addition to that, has been the impact of technology and the fact that for young people, increasingly, the primary way that they stay connected to their peers is not necessarily by seeing them in person, but by communicating through modes of communication like Facebook and Twitter, also through the use of cell phones. And I think increasingly what we're finding is that type of lifestyle is one that is much more consistent with a lifestyle in which one is using public transportation or walking where one needs to go or staying at home, as opposed to being in a car.
Well, we're just hearing about this now for the first time. You've had obviously some time to digest all of this data. What are you thinking about implications from this?
Well, I think one implication is that it definitely suggests that in the United States that we need to take a serious look at our transportation policies and where we invest our taxpayer dollars in the building of new transportation capacity. We've done a very good job over the last 60 years, really ever since World War II, in building a lot of highways, in building a transportation system and a land use system in which many people feel as though they need to have a car in order to conduct their daily lives. I think what these new trends are telling us is that young people may be looking for something different than their parents or their parents' parents did in terms of the types of places where they want to live and the types of transportation options that they want to have available to them. And I think that as policymakers and decision makers are thinking about what are the types of things that we want to be investing in for the next 40 to 60 years with our taxpayer money and our transportation system, that they need to take those preferences into account.
Tony Dudzik, Senior Policy Analyst at the Frontier Group. Thank you very much.
That's great. Thank you, David.
After the Japanese tsunami last year shut down auto parts factories for weeks, the world learned how fragile the global supply chain really is. Now, we've got a new lesson. A key component for building cars, both here and around the world, has been nearly decimated by an explosion a couple of weeks ago in Germany. The BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin has more now on the missing plastic.
It's not the sexiest name, but the important stuff is called cyclododecatriene, or CDT for short. And it matters, because it's used to make a resin essential to the braking and fuel systems of cars. When a fire shut down production at a plant in Germany, there might not have been big headlines around the world. But it turns out that perhaps a quarter to a half of the world's supply was cut, and will be cut for at least the next 3 months. Tim Urquhart is an analyst with IHS Automotive.
It's potentially quite a pretty serious problem because this plant is one of the few plants in the world that manufactures this particular chemical. So it's going to be extremely difficult for sort of the manufacturers to source alternative materials at short notice.
It set off alarm bells in Detroit. This week, 200 executives from anybody who's anybody in the world car industry met. They've formed a string of committees to assess the situation and seek alternatives. All this comes as the U.S. auto industry starts to pick up after the global downturn. So the fear is that this chemical made in a plant in Germany may slow that acceleration down. In Berlin, I'm the BBC's Steve Evans for Marketplace.
While some cavernous retailers of the big box variety are closing locations, Guitar Center, the largest chain selling musical instruments, is adding stores. A new one opens today in North Carolina. Marketplace's Eve Tro put an ear to the ground.
Musical instrument sales are stronger than ever, thanks in part to an uptick in private lessons. Just ask Chris Catalano, CEO of School of Rock.
So we are a performance-based music education company, roughly 79 schools open.
He aims for 115 schools this year. The boost in demand for music gear could help retailers, but most of that growth is online sales, says Paul Majeski, publisher of Music Trades magazine. And Guitar Center has lots of debt, even after Bain Capital privatized it 5 years ago. Majeski can't say why Guitar Center's adding retail space, but says the new stores do feel different.
They're making their stores a little bit more of a destination. They've got service. They never had service before. And they have teaching. They never had teaching before.
Maybe you bring in your Stratocaster for a tune-up, watch an in-store concert, hang out while your kids learn the drums. And you may just decide you have to have that ukulele you've been noodling on now, instead of going home and ordering it online. I'm Eve Tro from Marketplace.
Well, David, if you feel like you're a caged animal when you're at work, now mm-hmm. you have a place to go on vacation where you can feel just the same way. A hotel in France is offering guests the chance to live life like a hamster.
Fabulous.
You will have an exercise wheel in your room, one of those wheels that hamsters go around in. You'll be able to feast on a meal of organic hamster grains, just like you've always wanted, and sip water on all fours, all for the low, low price of $143 a night. Book now while supplies last, I must say, because I'm sure that they're going to be going very fast.
I know that when I travel to France, it's to eat hamster food.
Yeah, really. Not a Coco Van this time. Let's get some hamster grains.
And finally, is this the final frontier when it comes to the fetishization of Apple computer products? Some artists have asked a company that manufactures artificial smells to distill the aroma of a newly opened MacBook Pro. Kind of like the new car scent, only it's the smell of laptop. The LA Times reporter who broke this big story went around sniffing her other electronic equipment. But please do not do this right now. It is just annoying. The smell company, Air Aroma, does not plan to market its creation yet.
What will they think of next? In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.